This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we are slated to hear from Stephen Himesfield, the executive director of the Pennington Biomedical Research Center right here in our community. He and his staff have unearthed a fascinating study that has received worldwide attention in the last few weeks, saying that a few extra pounds may be good for you. We'll talk with Dr. Himesfield about this remarkable revelation. Also, Denny McLean, the last man to win 30 games in a major league season. It happened in 1968. He's slated to be with us to discuss the snubbing of Barry Bonds and Roger Clemens for the Hall of Fame this week. And we'll talk with him about whether steroids should be a cause for keeping people out of the shrine. All this, now the news on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Your numbers are 877-217-5757. Locally, it's 297-5633, and you may reach us through email at inkstershow@wrkf.org. Our leadoff guest is Dr. Stephen Himesfield. He's the executive director of the Pennington Biomedical Research Center, located right in the heart of our community. He's been at Pennington for 2.5 years, and a recent study conducted by his staff has been depicted in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, USA Today, but I've yet to read anything locally about the Pennington study. But it is gaining a lot of attention nationally and even internationally. Just when a majority of Americans are gearing up to make good on New Year's resolutions, this new report suggests that fear about extra weight might be overblown. Why is that, Dr. Stephen Himesfield?
Well, good morning, Jim. The reason people are so concerned about this is that, as you know, we promote the idea that people should be normal weight, quote, normal weight. And that's based on body mass index, which is a measure of your weight adjusted for height. And this study showed that people who were a little overweight actually had a lower risk of dying than people who were normal weight.
What is a little overweight?
About 10 or 15% or so. So maybe another 10 or 20 pounds for most people.
Well, that's significant. If a person is, let's say their ideal weight's 180 pounds.
Yes.
All right, 10 or 20%, 10 or 15, you said.
Yeah, say 10% overweight.
That puts them at 200.
That's right.
You're saying that's good.
Well, that's what this study showed. The study actually came from the Center for Disease Control, and they evaluated almost 3 million people over a period of time. And with this analysis, they found that, as defined by the Center for Disease Control, the people who were in that overweight range, like you said, 10 or 20 pounds overweight, were actually at about a 5% lower risk of dying prematurely than people who are normal weight.
But to put this in perspective, a 180-pound man who's in good shape is still going to have about 15% body fat.
Well, so, maybe not. It depends how physically active they are.
On the average, I'd say 15.
Right.
So 15% yes. of 180 pounds is 27 pounds. You add another 20 pounds to that, you're up to 47 pounds. Then we're 47 of 200, we're at 23.5% body fat. You're saying the study indicates that a person at 23.5% body fat may actually live longer than somebody at 15%.
That's what the study appeared to show. But in the article that accompanied the paper, which is what my colleague Will Cefalo and I wrote, we tried to explain the findings. So one idea is that, in fact, people do live longer who are a little overweight. But there are other ideas out there. For example, that perhaps the range of normal that the scientists at the CDC used, maybe that range was not really a healthy range. And let me explain that just a little bit. The normal range is quite wide for body mass index. And people who have a low body mass index are actually at increased risk of dying, increased risk. And so the thought is maybe the range they use for, quote, normal was a little too wide.
Well, and body mass index is something that people who are muscular often say, look, they're off the chart on body mass index, but their body fat may be lower than somebody who weighs 20 or 30 pounds less than they do.
That's absolutely correct. And that's not a common problem, but it is a common problem, particularly young people, people who are physically active. And I did a lot of work with the military, and we continue to do that at Pennington. And military recruits often have high body mass index but have a low body fat.
297-5633 is your number. The Pennington study, according to some reports, could pose a setback to the $60-plus billion, that's billion with a B, weight loss industry, which typically sees its strongest demand in the first few months of a new year because of all the New Year's resolutions. So some would say also that you might live longer, but your quality of life might not be as good as somebody who's in shape like you are.
Yes, that's absolutely right. So this study really was based on total mortality, but not on quality of life or the risk of developing diseases such as diabetes, which is very common when you're overweight. And one of the theories is that people who are a little overweight and develop conditions like diabetes actually get treated earlier and more aggressively than people who are normal weight with those conditions. So that helps them live a little longer, but they still have this disease that was brought about by being overweight.
Well, Dr. Himesfield is quoted in the New York Times as saying overweight people with normal indicators such as cholesterol might not need to go on a crash diet.
Well, I think there's some legitimacy to the idea that the weight and body mass index alone is not the only measure you should consider. So if you're overweight and your cholesterol is high, then you might want to go on a diet. If your cholesterol is normal and you're overweight, you might not be as pressed to do it. I wouldn't say there's a good reason to be overweight, but the urgency would be less.
Dr. Stephen Himesfield on the cutting edge of interesting research. And the other factor here is that you had a study earlier in the year that was quite provocative as well. How does the earlier study mix with this current one?
Which one was that?
Well, the other one was that exercise may not benefit everybody.
Oh, that's correct. Well, that's a very, you know, I think that ties in very nicely. That was work done by Dr. Bouchard and others at Pennington. And in that study, they showed that people who go on a very active and aggressive exercise program, some of them actually have a worsening of their risk factors like high blood pressure, cholesterol, and so on. And so just by virtue of going on a very active exercise program doesn't guarantee your risk factors are going to improve.
877-217-5757, wherever you may be, for Dr. Stephen Himesfield, 2.5 years head of the Pennington Biomedical Research Center. This is what they do. They measure quality of life aspects, and obesity is considered to be an epidemic in this country by many. And it's something that is obviously a consideration for what's going on in our world, but according to your study, maybe we're taking our concerns a bit too far.
Well, I'm not sure that that's the final conclusion, but it does throw some questions into what is the optimum weight for people to live the longest. And that has been a controversy for a while, and it's bubbled around in the scientific community, and it's now just reaching the surface. But some people think thinner is better, and others think the weight can be a little higher. And we're still trying to sort out what's the best weight for the population as a whole.
Okay. How many people were in the study?
This study was actually a compilation of many studies that the CDC put together, and it was almost 3 million people, which is actually the largest study of this type to date.
Mm-hmm. Some people want to lose weight to look better in their clothes. It's kind of like having a surgery to repair crooked teeth or something else. It's a cosmetic thing in addition to a lifestyle thing. Your body didn't come out of central casting. I'm sure you work hard to stay fit.
I do. I work hard at it. And I think that appearance does drive a lot of the weight loss that people want to accomplish. But they should concentrate on health. Of course, that's the most important part. You know, the old saying, you can never be too rich or too thin. And I think that's something that's in the minds of many people.
297-5633. You can never be too rich or too thin, says Dr. Stephen Himesfield, Pennington Biomedical Research Center. Carter in Lafayette. Carter, you're on the air with Dr. Himesfield.
Hello, good morning. About 10 years ago, I was in the effort of trying to lose weight, and I was running marathon. I did a triathlon, week or so. Couldn't get my weight up.
All right, he's fading, Carter is, as you can hear, but I think I got the gist of his comments. He was saying he was running triathlons and still not losing weight.
This is a very interesting question. The effect of exercise, of course, exercise is wonderful. It improves fitness, improves many metabolic effects. But one side effect of exercise not well appreciated is that people also eat more. They compensate. And so there is a phenomenon where when people go on diets and they exercise, they don't lose as much weight as they think they should. And some of that is actually due to some degree of compensation. That's subtle, and it's often not apparent, but it does occur.
Well, the esteemed economist, Dr. Lauren Scott, who's been on this show a few times, he once said not so long ago on this program that poor people in our country are fat, and it may have something to do with diet. But is there any kind of correlation between wealth and girth, or there, lack thereof?
There absolutely is. There's a very strong correlation between socioeconomic status and weight or body mass index. People who have lower socioeconomic status tend to have higher body mass index, and that's a great concern. And the exact cause of that isn't clear, but definitely social inequality is a major cause or relationship to body mass index.
297-5633 for Dr. Stephen Himesfield from Pennington. Andrew on Highland. Hi, Andrew. You're on the air with Dr. Himesfield.
I think it's interesting. I see a lot of poor people that are thin. It comes down to, and I truly believe, that diet and exercise, it comes down to people making wise choices. That's all it is. They don't have to eat the amount, the portions, and they don't have to eat the type of foods that they do consume, sugars and the white flour and all of that. And there's one more thing. I've talked to several doctors, and they say they have never seen an overweight 90-year-old. Never.
Overweight what? An overweight 90-year-old. You generally have people who live to be of a long
yes.
age. They are not fat.
That's true. And that does raise a very important point, which is the study that was published also did show that people who were obese had a shorter lifespan. So the overweight was the controversial part, but the study did reinforce once again that if you're seriously obese, that your risk of dying early and prematurely was significantly increased.
Well, we have a stigma against weight in this country that goes beyond the health issues. Is that something that is also at play here?
Well, the social stigma of obesity is very significant. It occurs in all phases of life, employment, social interactions, and so on, and it is a major problem. It seems to be loosening up a little bit as the population gets more obese. There is more tolerance of people who are overweight. We see more advertisements with people who are overweight or obese as compared to stick models, which was a feature of the past. But still, there is a huge social consequence of being overweight or obese.
But 50 years ago, a man of your size would be considered to be an average person. Today, you're considered probably on the thin side.
Yes, which is only one-third of Americans have a normal weight. And that, by the way, I should say my body mass index is 24. And the upper limit is 24.9. So overweight, I would only need a few more pounds.
And really?
Yes.
And may I ask, how much do you weigh?
I weigh about 155, and I'm about 5'6". So my BMI is just...
But you're obviously muscular.
Yes. So I exercise regularly. You're probably a little overweight.
Me?
Jim.
I would agree. We'll talk more about that when we return.
Yeah.
After this 90-second timeout. on WRK. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Dr. Stephen Himesfield is with us, the executive director of the Pennington Biomedical Research Center. And he and his staff have unveiled a report, and scientists across the land are weighing this literally, saying that if you're a little bit overweight, you might actually live longer. Dr. Himesfield, who looks lean and mean, said he's 5'6", 155, so he's at the outer range of appropriate body mass. Now, and he made the comment to me as we went to the break that I'm a little bit overweight, and I would agree, but in our society today, quite often people think of me as being not overweight, but I would agree. I'm 6'1", right at 6'1", 207 pounds. I have about 20% body fat. Mm-hmm. I probably ought to be at about 15%. So in order to get to that rate, I would have to lose about 11 pounds.
That's correct. You're actually very close to being right. So you would be in that range of people in the study that actually had a slightly better mortality than people who are normal weight like me.
But I'd like to lose 11 pounds.
Well, it'd probably be a good idea if you checked your blood pressure mm-hmm. and your other risk factors. Are they okay?
They're okay.
Okay, well.
Cholesterol's high, but it's always been high. I take medication, but blood pressure's okay.
Then you're probably in that range where the risk is low. But we're still not sure how to interpret the study. I should say that.
And as I approach my 55th birthday next week, I can still bench press my weight several times.
Well, that's important.
It's
good that you're getting good physical activity.
Well, I think that's the key, is to have some common sense here. And I think most people know when it's getting out of control. And I'd like to be 10 pounds less than I am right now, but I have a sedentary job. I'm not exercising right now other than flapping my gums. And because of that, have to work a little harder when I get away from here.
Well, you know, we should say that body mass index is just a very simple, rough estimate of your health risk and your weight. But people who are fit and overweight also have a lower risk. So being fit is important in addition to having a normal BMI or even being overweight.
And we've noted, Dr. Himesfield, that in this community, in the community being the state of Louisiana, there are a lot of temptations to deal with as far as weight control.
Well, this is a difficult environment, and I can say that coming from New York City, where the environment promoted much more physical activity in daily life than you might necessarily get here, being sedentary like we are. You have to go to the subway, you walk to the grocery store here, you drive everywhere. So that there's a few hundred calories a day probably just simply because of where we live.
Well, in one of the stories I saw regarding your study in the New York Times, it quoted a lady who was 5'7 and 171 pounds. Now, her body mass index is 27. Now, this is the kind of person we're talking about, but anything above 25 is considered to be overweight, right?
That's correct.
So what's the difference between 25 and 27 and 30?
Well, 27 is in the overweight range, and this is the range that's in dispute. Body mass index of 30 is obese, and that's clearly no argument exists there about that being a health risk.
So 5'7", 171, as you know, in 1965, that would be considered wildly, morbidly obese. It's not today.
That's right. That's right. Today, the whole population has shifted. About a third of Americans are in that range, in the overweight range, which is a very large number of people.
So is this going to change, or are we going to continue to get bigger and bigger and bigger?
There's some evidence that the body mass index of the population as a whole is gradually leveling off. Some people think it's slowed, that it may reach its sort of stable level in 2030, so quite a ways off. But there's evidence, for example, that in children, a body mass index is stabilizing somewhat.
It's stabilizing.
Stabilizing.
I saw a report recently that said that it may actually be improving a bit.
Slightly, yes. So some of the data is conflicting, but we certainly don't want to be where we are right now with two-thirds of people being overweight or obese. This is very significant.
Should we ban sugary drinks?
Well, I think banning sugary drinks, we'd be eliminating a lot of foods. But we certainly should be educated to know that drinking large amounts of sugary drinks is going to put you at risk for weight gain.
Well, sugary drinks may actually be as harmful as things that are more known to be deadly or certainly not health-inducing, like cigarettes and things like that. Sugar is a killer, isn't it?
Well, it's sugar, of course, is essential for life. We have to have a certain amount of sugar. But in excess, it's potentially dangerous, particularly when it might replace something like water, people drinking water, or even milk. And I'll give you a reason why. When you drink something like milk, it has protein and other nutrients in it. It has more of an appetite-suppressing effect and less adverse metabolic effects in the body than just simply drinking water with sugar in it.
Mm-hmm. So the Pennington Biomedical Research Center is on the cutting edge of health in America. And where do you go from here? What's the next big study for your crew?
Well, we're doing studies all over the world. For example, we're looking at different physical activity patterns in countries as far-ranging as India and China. And we're very interested to see how activity patterns and cultures differ. We're doing extensive studies in the military. We're the largest military contractor for nutrition research outside of the military itself. And so we're doing a lot of studies looking at different dietary components and activity measures in the military, including the National Guard here in Louisiana.
And you said earlier that some military people are not, as far as BMI goes, they're not in the best of condition.
That's right. So there's a thing in the military called readiness. Of course, you can immediately understand what readiness is. And in the military, it's very important that soldiers be fit, that they be healthy, and in fact, when they retire, that they have long healthy lives. And one of the problems in the military is it's harder to find normal weight recruits and keep them in at a normal weight than it used to be.
Well, we thank you for joining us today. Dr. Stephen Himesfield, who's encouraged me to go out and lose 10 pounds.
Right. Thanks very much, Jim.
All right. Good to visit with you, and congratulations on the national recognition that this study has received.
Great. Thank you.
My pleasure. And we're joined now by Denny McClain. Since 1934, only one man in Major League Baseball has won 30 games in a season, and it's our guest, Denny McClain, who won 31 games in 1968 as a 24-year-old with the world champion Detroit Tigers. And he is here to talk about what happened this week regarding the Baseball Hall of Fame in Cooperstown. It was a shutout, and it was the most stellar cast of possibilities in the history of the Hall, probably, and gone, at least not this time around, not accepted in the Shrine. Barry Bonds and Roger Clemens and many others, including Sammy Sosa, and most of the complaints regard steroid use, at least alleged steroid use, performance-enhancing drugs. Denny McClain, good morning to you.
Good morning, young man. How are you today?
I'm doing well. What do you think about particularly Bonds and Clemens getting nixed by the Hall and the writers?
Well, they've been, normally 500 home runs was always the qualifier to get in the Hall of Fame for a guy that hit home runs. All we got to do is go back in a little bit of time and see where McGuire didn't get in, despite how many home runs he hit and the numbers that he hit every year. Of course, they later found out the juice was prevalent in his life, as well as all these other guys. And I'll tell you, I've got two lines of thought here. One is, they should never get in the Hall of Fame. That's number one. And number two, all of a sudden the writers, the people who vote, whoever they may be, who vote on the people who qualify for the Hall of Fame in some form, have become the morality judges for Major League Baseball and the Hall of Fame. I mean, that's really an oxymoron. I played a long time, and I saw a lot of nasty writers do a lot of nasty things. And all of a sudden, though, that's the judge and the jury, I think, is kind of at least disingenuous. And you know, I think they, at this point in time, they've got such controversy with the Hall of Fame that they may have to go back and draw up some new rules. They may have to go back and draw up a new way of inducting people, because we had Jack Morris up here. Now, he probably, in a regular year, wouldn't even be talked about because he had an ERA of almost 4. But they had at least one guy who certainly qualified for the Hall of Fame, Biggio. Biggio had over 3,000 hits. That's an automatic ticket into the Hall of Fame. So I don't know. Everybody kind of went their own directions. I know some people voted for people outside of baseball, for God's sakes. So, I mean, and if you're going to do that, why even send in a vote?
Well, Craig Biggio, as you mentioned, 3,000 hits, did not get in. And right. In his case, no allegations of
none
of performance-enhancing drugs.
Now, may I add one thing?
Sure.
I'm not going to say Biggio used any juice. I mean, I just don't know. But I would suggest to you that I got a good chuckle the other day. I think they were talking, somebody had talked to one of my guys who I pitched with. I think it was Lolas, but I wouldn't swear to it right now. But they had asked him, well, what if the juice was around when you were playing? And Lolas, and I'm not positive, so I apologize to him if I've got the wrong guy. But the answer was simple. Oh, hell yeah, I would have tried it at the end of my career. I mean, and as frankly as I can be, I think I would have too. I mean, it's you know what, at that point in time, you're at the end of your career, you're still making, well, we didn't make the kind of money to make today, certainly, but we were making $60,000, $70,000 a year, which was nothing to laugh at, but nonetheless, it's not the $1, $2, $3, $5, $25 million a year that they make today. So we would have fought real hard, I think, to maintain ourselves. But, you know, there wasn't really anything to sustain a career. The only thing that you got from time to time was some pain med from the trainer who would give it to you so you could get loose if you had a bad arm. And that was about it. I mean, yeah, they used greenies, the speed capsules once in a while. For some of these guys, none of us could ever see the difference. I mean, I think after a while, probably that stuff, you become immune to it, and the effects of it, if in fact there are any to begin with, wind up being nil.
297-5633 or 877-217-5757 outside the area for Dennis Dale McLean, the man who won 31 games in 1968, then won 24. Another Cy Young Award-winning season in 69 for the Tigers, and then had all kinds of arm trouble, which caused him to have an early exit in his career. You said that you used, cortisone. In our last conversation, you acknowledged that. Isn't that a steroid?
Yeah, it is a steroid. It's a different kind of steroid, of course. But what the steroid in cortisone is to do, and I'm sure there's a doctor out there that can clarify this a lot better than I can, despite the number of shots I've got, they never did give me my MD degree. they try to shoot the injured area, and they lied to us. I mean, they 110% lied to us. They said the cortisone was the miracle drug back then. And what they would do is they would shoot us, first of all, with, I think it was xylocaine, which would numb the arm. And then they would try to go in there and find the spot that was injured. And the spot that was injured, it was inflammation around the injured area. So the cortisone was to take down the inflammation and therefore would take some of the pain away. But they told us it was a cure-all drug. I mean, I had over 120 of these damn shots the last 4 years that I played ball, the last 5 years I played ball. I mean, it was an extraordinary number of shots. And, you know, but you kept believing the trainer, you kept believing the team doctor, and as long as you could get somebody out, you were still their guy, and they were going to throw you out there. Because it was so much different. You know, we weren't even allowed to really have attorneys, accountants, people who would look out for your welfare. I mean, and if you walked into an office to negotiate a contract with the general manager with an attorney, well, they'd say, hey, listen, I got to go right now. Call me in a couple of weeks when I'm available. So they hated the idea of somebody getting involved in our lives and actually pretending or doing the job to try to protect our welfare for the future.
But 120 shots, and we're talking, you were still in your 20s. The health impact of that is not good. Cortisone can cause heart trouble. It has some detrimental effects to health that I would think you've had to deal with since.
There, you know, there is some truth to the fact that I was told, you know, by one doctor a number of years ago, it's been a while now, he told me, he says, now listen, you're going to put weight on because of all the cortisone shots. It has an effect to slow down your metabolism. And, well, you know what, I've eaten enough Twinkies in my life not to worry about my metabolism, although now it's very tough to find a Twinkie. So life has changed since the great Twinkie has disappeared, although we do hear some good news that somebody's going to buy them and reintroduce them. But, no, I can't blame cortisone on my weight increase. As a matter of fact, I give you a scoop. In about three or four, I just went through three events of congestive heart failure about over the last 4 or 5 months, and never want to do that again. But secondly, I'm going to have an operation for my weight. It's called the sleeve, and it tells me that within 9 or 10 months I should be able to lose 100, 125 pounds. So by getting rid of at least one small person that I'm carrying around every day, I got a hunch life has to get better.
Well, the last time we talked, one of the items that was most discussed afterward, people asked me, they said, did Denny really drink 100 Pepsis a day?
Oh, not 100, but I still, even today, although I've cut way back, I still drink 8 or 10 a day even now. And up until my first event of congestive heart failure, I was drinking 15 or 20 a day easily. You know, and let me back off that just a hair. I was opening 15 or 20 a day. I don't know how many I really finished. But I was certainly opening 15 to 20 a day.
Well, getting back to the Hall of Fame, we've got a guy in the hall, you know him, Gaylord Perry, pitched against
great guy.
Him. Yeah. But he wrote a book called Me and the Spitter, in which he revealed that he cheated. In fact, he enjoyed beating the system, and yet they put him in the Hall of Fame. He deserves to be there. But is that really any different than using performance-enhancing drugs?
Oh, sure, sure. I mean, listen, and I'm not saying he deserves to be in the Hall of Fame because of his admission, but please don't misunderstand me. But, you know, the spitter is like shoeless Joe Jackson. Did he really play baseball shoeless? The bottom line is it's part of the folklore of the game. And Gaylord's psychology on it, by the way, you know, Gaylord was a pretty good pitcher to begin with, spitter or no spitter. He threw the ball real hard. I mean, he was probably an 80% fastball pitcher. And he was a giant on the mound. My God, when he started to put a little weight on at the end of his career, he looked like the 800-pound gorilla coming at you. And terrific guy, funny guy. In fact, one quick story. Digress for just a second. A couple years ago, I was having dinner with him in Vegas at a place that served ribs, a Bobby Brown or Bobby Roma or something like that. And
All right.
Dinner. I ordered the ribs like he did. He had 3 portions of ribs by the time, and I can eat. He had 3 portions of ribs within 20, 25 minutes, and he asked for the check while I was still finishing my first set of ribs. I mean, I'm going to tell you, this man can eat. And you know, him and his brother Jim, of course. Jim won a lot of ball games, too. Great guys, great gentlemen, but I know what you're trying to say, but I think the spitter is a whole lot different.
All right, we'll be back with Denny McClain after this 90-second timeout. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Outside the area, it's 877-217-5757. Kevin, I think we may have lost Denny McClain, Kevin. So please call him back and see if we can restore contact with the man who in 1968 set the world afire with 31 victories for the Detroit Tigers at the age of 24. 1969, a year later, he won 24 games for the Tigers, won another Cy Young Award. And Denny McClain had arm troubles and all kinds of other problems, but particularly arm troubles that kept his career from advancing after that, winning just 17 games the remainder of his career. But he said he got 120 shots of cortisone during the course of the last 5 years of his career. Today, as we know, many major leaguers used performance-enhancing drugs, And as a result, perhaps the greatest player of all time, Barry Bonds, only got 36% of the votes necessary to be in the Hall. 75% is what is required. And Roger Clemens, who won 354 games, only got 37% of the votes. Denny McClain, you were talking about Gaylord Perry when we went to the break. Obviously, Clemens has stats that exceed those of Gaylord Perry and many other Hall of Famers. Will there be a day when Clemens and Bonds get in, or is it over for them?
No, I don't think it'll be, to be honest with you, I don't think it'll be for many, many years. Keep this in mind, too. Clemens and Bonds and a whole bunch of the other ones were not very nice to the media, although there's no rule in baseball that says you got to kiss their butt, but if you do, you got a better chance of getting some things done. And Roger was famous for being nasty as hell with him during and after a ball game. Barry was worse. And then some of the other guys also who have qualified are going to find out that they're not going to get in. I think that's the reason why, despite Jack Morris's ERA of almost four, I think that's the reason why Morris didn't get in last year or this year, because of his personality. I mean, it's just plain nasty. And, you know, people have an ability to recall what happened to them 20, 25 years ago when they went up there and said, hey, listen, can I sit down with you for 5 minutes and do a piece with you? And you'd say, hell no, I don't have time right now. That would always come back to haunt you, and I think that's part of Morris's problem. And that's tough to get over, because the writer today is a whole bunch of different kind of guy than they were 25, 30, 40 years ago.
Well, did you embrace writers when you were at the top of your game?
Listen, I love the media. I not because I love them, but I could see early on in my career what they were able to do for you if you were positive with them, that you did and said the right things. I mean, I had two long-term contracts, one with the Hammond Organ Company for 25 years, and then I had one with Pepsi, which almost was as long. And I didn't get those because I was a pitcher. I got those because of my personality, which came through in the newspapers. So with knowing that and recognizing that relatively early in my career, a lot of good things happened to me.
Well, a guy like Bonds, some would say, why does he even care? But they do care.
The first day you put on a major league uniform, don't tell me that thought doesn't go through your head. Back in my day, of course, we didn't see the great big ceremony associated with being inducted. Today, you see it from 6 in the morning until 4 o'clock in the afternoon, the entire procession of people. All of the Hall of Famers, you're there sitting on a dais with all of the other players. You become one of them. It's quite an honor. And I'll tell you what else happens, and I think this is one of the big, and I'm serious, this is not the number one reason, but certainly the second or third reason. Guys who are doing card shows up until the day they're getting inducted in the Hall of Fame make about half of what they will make if they get in the Hall of Fame. So a guy who's making $2,000 or $3,000 every time they do a card show, all of a sudden his fee automatically doubles, goes to $5,000, $6,000, $7,000 in appearance. So there's some real serious benefits, and the Hall of Fame and people associated with it will make sure that they get work during the year to make other appearances, dinners and Little League this and Little League that. And it's a lot of good things come out of it. But essentially, I don't think they have to worry about working the rest of their life.
Craig asked how many members of the 68 Tigers are in the Hall. I think there's only one.
I think, yeah, it's only K-Line. We got one other guy that certainly qualifies. Bill Freehan was an All-Star 10 or 11 times. Meaning he was the best catcher in the American League, best catcher I ever pitched to. Nobody even close, and he never even gets a mention. Bill now is sick. He's got Alzheimer's or dementia. And, it's a sad thing to see a man who was that kind of an athlete, played for the U of M football team, played a little basketball. I mean, he was a super, super athlete and a very bright guy. He was the first guy that I ever saw who went to bed thinking about tomorrow's ball game, how he was going to call the game, how he was going to demand his pitcher does this or does this in certain situations. But he was the first guy I ever saw that really studied the game.
I remember he wrote a book called Behind the Mask.
Yep, he sure did. Yep, he, listen, it's, and again, it didn't get the play it should have gotten because the book company who was behind it, you know, they obviously didn't have the resources to put it the way it could have been promoted.
Well, it came out, I believe, the same time as Ball 4. And, Denny, I know you're a numbers guy, and we've talked about your stats. My goodness, in 1968, you worked 336 innings, then pitched in the World Series. A year later, 325 innings. Today, pitchers don't do that, and maybe that explains why they tend to last a little longer today. But last time we spoke, we were talking about Steven Strasburg being put down before the end of the year. The Washington Nationals might have been world champs if they had allowed him to pitch in the postseason.
I'll guarantee you one thing. I believe with his kind of stuff and what he could do for the morale of that ball club, they weren't going to play any harder with him or any less with him without him. But the bottom line is you got a guy that's going to win three or four more ball games for you. I mean, and you know what? They never even had an opportunity to play those games. And it's a tragedy what they did to that organization who hasn't won anything in a million years. And I played for them the last year in 1971, which was, you know, listen, we had more players on the field one night in September than we had people at the park. That's a true story. You know, not counting the ushers and what have you. But it was miserable playing there. Of course, we had a lot of people that we voted in the office there, too, that really don't help. But anyway, that's another time, another story.
Well,
but the bottom line simply is he's got a pitch. That's what they're paying him for. I know the owner thinks he's saving an asset, but again, I'll ask you the same question. If he got hurt 2 years ago, I still ask you, weren't they that smart 2 years ago, not knowing he was going to get hurt the year before? Mm-hmm. So they know this past year that he was going to get hurt. It makes no sense, you know. I mean, it's hindsight is awful, and the worst thing they should have done is let him pitch at least a game in each playoff series. And unfortunately, this game doesn't guarantee you another appearance. It never guarantees you another appearance. And, you know, he may take that one for the rest of his career and wonder what could have been, what could have happened.
Would you have voted for Clemens the other day if you had a vote?
No, I don't. The way he acted, the way Andy Pettit all of a sudden changed his testimony about the, you know, Clemens got to him somehow, some way. And when Pettit changed his testimony in the federal trial, I lost all my respect for Roger because it was so much better to just come out. They had enough DNA to there's a lot of people on death row today with about 50% of the DNA that they had on Roger. And, you know, it was a travesty. It was one of those things that probably will go down, not in history the way it probably should, but they sure killed the story immediately after the thing was over.
What about Bonds?
Barry's never going to get in. I mean, you look at those pictures to begin with, and, of course, there's all kinds of people that got him in their conversation in first tense, as a matter of fact. As good as he was, he didn't need the stuff, and the only reason he took the stuff is simply he wanted to play longer. And you know, I looked up a statistic the other day. In his 18 years in the big leagues, this is going to knock you over. In 18 years in the big leagues, Barry Bonds made $188 million. When is enough enough? You know, he may have not needed the last 10. So my point is simple. You know, he should have got out when it was time to get out, and he tried to hang on. He tried to do his thing. But mm-hmm. And that's what we all want to do. We all want to hang on because it's a great life. I've always said that people should walk in my shoes that I walked in 1968. You cannot believe how good life can be.
Bonds never won a world title, but in 2004, when he was 40 years old, I was looking at those in the same numbers you were the other day. He hit 362. He hit 45 home runs and 379 at bats, and he walked 232 times. His on base percentage was 61%.
Unbelievable.
At 40.
And that's right. And I just used the right word, too. I didn't think of it before, but it is unbelievable because without the juice, I mean, you don't come close to those numbers.
Well, Denny, thank you for joining us. Always a pleasure. And you can tell this man can speak as well as he once threw the ball. And we hope those heart problems that you talked about today will be resolved soon.
I appreciate it, young man. And when I lose my 125 pounds, I'll come see him. We'll go have a great meal. Of course, you can only eat about an ounce, but I'll eat through 2 ounces with you.
Well, good. Thank you, Denny. Take care.
Have a good one.
You
bye
too.
Bye.
Bye-bye. And now we're joined in studio by Amy Mitchell-Smith, former executive director of the Baton Rouge Film Commission, and she is involved in a major endeavor that's happening right now.
That's true. I'm here with a twofold perspective. One, I'm producing Zach Godshall. We all love Zach from his Sundance Endeavors, Lo and Behold, and Lord Byron. So we're collaborating on his next feature film, looking to shoot that in the spring. And then also I'm curating films for the Manship Theater. So I was hoping that we could talk today about all of the amazing films that are coming to Manship, specifically an amazing documentary that's going to be showing on Saturday night at Manship, 7 p.m., called Chapatulis. This is a New Orleans shot documentary that was actually produced by Court 13 that we've all seen have gotten about 4 Academy Award nominations for Beast of the Southern Wild. So we'll have Bill Ross in town for Chapatulis, and it's going to be quite a night at Manship tomorrow.
Tomorrow night, 7 o'clock, Chapatulis. What's the focus of Chapatulis?
So Chapatulis centers on 3 young brothers, and it is their sort of journey through the New Orleans nightlife. It's very impressionistic. It premiered South by Southwest, has won a lot of festivals in the documentary category over the past year. Bill Ross, the very talented director, is going to be with us for the evening. He's going to present the film and then do a Q&A after. But again, working with Court 13 and this collaborative of young, exciting filmmakers in New Orleans, we're hoping to bring some of that energy up here to Baton Rouge. It's going to be a great night to celebrate film. Also, frankly, I just watched the film myself last night, and it's got a great sort of carnival energy, so I feel like the timing is fortuitous that we're going to be showing this film right up before Mardi Gras.
7 o'clock, Manship Theater.
That's right.
Tomorrow night.
That's right.
And after Chapatulis, what comes next?
At Manship, we'll be screening Monday, Tuesday night, Late Quartet. This is a drama that stars Chris Walken, Philip Seymour Hoffman, Catherine Keener. It's going to really appeal to the symphony lovers, the classical music lovers in our community. They play a string quartet, a highly famous string quartet. Chris Walken ends up having a bit of a sickness, and it's sort of what happens to them and their music as a result of what happens, as he gets sick. Then you move into Jewish Film Festival at Manship for the rest of the month.
Mm-hmm.
Next month at Manship, we'll be screening a number of shorts from the Academy Awards. As we've all seen, the selection was mentioned yesterday. So lots of great films come into Manship, and I'm just hopeful that the community will continue to come out and see things. You know, it's a nice compliment to what you could see at the multiplex or Django's and whatnot.
Well, and the 4 Oscar nominations for Beast of the Southern Wild, that's strong stuff, isn't it?
Absolutely. That film is absolutely magical and an incredible love letter to Louisiana. Going back to the work I'm doing with Zach, it's really important that we all be mindful that we have this aggressive film tax credit program, and it's been key, very instrumental to bringing, productions from Hollywood, from New York and what have you into our market. But real sustainability comes from these young writer directors like Ben Zeitlin of Beast, like Zach Godshall, them making the work here, staying here. I think that's the overall objective for the industry here in Louisiana.
Right now, Amy, there's a lot of talk about the tax credits the film industry gets and whether that's a good thing. What's your take on this?
Well, I'll tell you, my 5 years that I was lucky enough to be the director of the Baton Rouge Film Commission, we were seeing about $200 million a year pumped into this local economy, amazing room nights and so forth. But the infrastructure that's been developed in our community, the vendors, the support service providers and the crew, there's something to be said for the value that we see locally as a result of those jobs. Many people who, moved here post Katrina, like myself, either came here with film experience as I did working at Miramax, or maybe they were just starting out. But some of those crew members that I was, you know, helping to get their first jobs back in 2007, now have mortgages in Baton Rouge, have started their families and so forth. So, you know, I think to see the real value of the tax credit program, we only need look at these young, very, very talented professionals that, you know, have set up home and started families here in our community.
Well, Amy's on the cutting edge of some good things happening in our community, and quite a year. And the Jewish Film Festival's next week. We'll be talking about that on our show.
Fabulous.
And tomorrow night, it's Chapatula, 7 o'clock. And next week on the show, our guests are slated to include Bill Maher coming to the River Center on January 27th, and Ernest Gaines, perhaps the greatest writer who ever lived, who's just a few miles across the river from us, who will be celebrating his 80th birthday in a few days. But thank you for joining us today. Hope you have a great weekend. We'll be back next week. For Kevin Gallagher, I'm Jim Engster. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.